and we were just talking very quickly, we are going to be putting all of these URLs that are being mentioned, we're going to put them up somewhere. We'll put them on the APA placement website somehow.
I can host a recording.
In a bit. And this is all being recorded, by the way, too. So somehow we will be getting this to you if you're taking poor notes. All right? Okay. Our next speaker is Max Kristoff of Google Wallet.
Hi. By the end of my third year at Princeton, I was ABD in classics and starting to work more closely with a core set of inspiring and talented advisors like Froma Zeitlin, Richard Martin, Andy Ford. I had a few prospective dissertation topics in Greek lyric and drama, particularly having to do with Pindaric scholia. And overall, I was reasonably optimistic about an academic professional future, despite the drumbeat of dreary and gloomy statistics about the job market. Today, I work as a software engineering manager at Google on a product called Wallet, and it's fair to say I could not have imagined this career path 13 years ago. In this discussion of alternative careers for classicists, I'll focus on two things. First, the difficult aspects of the decision process itself. What I won't do is provide a pros and cons checklist of the industry versus the academy, as if either of these entities are as monolithic as the term suggests, nor presume to convince you that a non-academic job is the right thing for you or all people. But I do hope to provide some insight on my own process and hopefully some pitfalls to avoid if you are in the same shoes. Second, I will discuss what parts of the ensuing transition were surprising, frustrating, or unexpectedly smooth. This, again, will be necessarily the recounting of a personal journey, but I hope you'll find elements that transcend the strictly autobiographical and anecdotal. And most of all, I want to leave you with a way to feel confident about whatever path you choose to follow. So with that, let me return to my graduate student days to provide some context. As mentioned, I was in the process of identifying a suitably challenging, evidence-driven, and highly original dissertation in Greek lyric. And to gain some teaching experience, I also taught an undergraduate course on Homeric epic, which did not result in terrible student reviews or too many rolled eyeballs, and this all sort of encouraged me further. All of this was going reasonably well. At the same time, I found it necessary to supplement my income during the summers with non-academic work, and because I could speak in coherent sentences, type at greater than 40 words per minute, and use Microsoft Office, I found a series of fairly drudgerous, my new favorite word, clerical jobs in New York City through temporary staffing agencies. One of these was at MTV, yes, the music video company. And there I was there to assist a technology team in the curation of a digital library of content. So let's see, organizing lots of stuff, curating things that I could do. They hired me for the summer strictly as a manual data entry monkey. And my job was to enter information about video clips, not in the least bit glamorous, but I could start to see quickly how technology was transforming what was a field of reels of tape how it was becoming a purely digital set of media. And I was genuinely curious about how the system worked. It started to reawaken and rekindle an interest in software that had lain dormant since my days as a 10-year-old in front of an Atari 800 XL computer. So the next summer, I wanted to do something more technical. And while I couldn't offer any actual programming skills, because I had none, I somehow wanted to be closer to the action. So my next temp job was, as we heard, to marshal my skills as a project manager and apply to Morgan Stanley's IT department, again, as a temp. Nothing glamorous, but now I was working directly alongside software engineers who were writing the code that made the systems work, and I was just fascinated by this. After getting to know a few of them, I just decided to ask one of the engineers, who seemed the sharpest, well, how did you do this? And I'd like to learn about these systems, and where would you recommend I start? To my surprise, this particular senior engineer told me that his MA a decade ago had been in medieval history, which suddenly explained a lot of the books that he had on his desk, and that he more or less learned it on the job. So he handed me 3 books on programming, and without hesitation, I read them cover to cover. And in a few days, I was starting to make my drudgerous administrative job more interesting by writing programs to automate some aspects. And I started to find small ways to contribute technically to the system that the team was building. So over the next couple of years and summers, as I worked, I continued to deepen these technical skills learning, still reading voraciously. And as the skills improved, I had the opportunity to work on more and more interesting things. And as the challenges began to move from strictly technical to more creative and higher order kinds of thinking. I kept in contact with these folks as I returned each academic year to my studies. And eventually, one spring, I found a job offer awaiting me at Morgan Stanley for full-time employment in their technology department. I was ecstatic. Now came the hard part, what to do. So at this point, the usual mechanical apparatus emerged for difficult decisions. Pro and con checklists were dutifully created with apple and orange categories of measurable benefits such as salary and vacation and bonus, totted up against intangibles like interest and things like this. However, after enumerating the advantages and disadvantages, and after many probably tedious rounds of conversation with friends and family, I didn't feel much closer to a decision. I was still deeply conflicted, and I couldn't put my finger on why. I couldn't help by asking myself why I would abandon the path now before even finishing, after I'd come so far, when I hadn't yet even conducted a single academic job interview. And the more literature I read about human decision-making, the more I realized I was at risk of falling prey to the well-studied fallacy of the sunk cost effect. The idea that I invested all this time, schooling, late nights, mental energy for naught was haunting me on some level. I started to recognize that the sunk cost bias would probably be even stronger if I had completed the PhD and were to start the job hunt, because at that point, more time and energy would have been invested, and I would have, as the psychologists like to say, escalated my commitment to a course of action. To escape this pattern of thinking, the first requirement is forward-looking analysis, that is, to consider the decision on its own terms, without regard for investment made to date. Instead of framing the question in your mind as, now that I've come so far, should I quit the field to pursue a promising non-academic job, the question becomes, regardless of how I arrived at this point, how do I want to spend the next year, 3 years, or 10 years of my life? The past can't be changed, the decision affects only the future. But the second part of escaping sunk cost thinking is to recognize that even this idea of throwing away the education is fallacious. Serious graduate study in classics leaves deep imprints and permanently transforms your powers of analysis, interpretation, and persuasion. The education isn't for naught when applied to a non-academic career path. It's instead being leveraged in a different way. More on that later. Fear was the second factor that complicated my decision. And there were two particular types of fear, and are two particular types of fear that I believe people who consider this transition must face. The first is a fear caused by the apparent finality of the decision. The antidote in this case is to lower the risk of the decision, particularly by realizing that decisions are often more reversible than one might think. While it may be difficult, it is usually possible, as we've heard, to go back. What's truly the worst that could happen? If, in fact, I had been filled with buyer's remorse after trying a non-academic path for 12 or 18 months, the dissertation would still be waiting for me. Certainly, it would be hard in all kinds of ways to get back into it, but it was possible if I wanted it. This made the decision feel less final and freed me to consider more on the basis of its own merits. The second fear is that of failure, both being branded somehow as a failed academic and failing in my new non-academic career. Coping with the former was chiefly a matter of realizing that I had not actually failed, but was taking a decision in my own hands about a choice of career directions. The only failure here would be to avoid the decision and let the inertia of my current path guide my way. As for the latter, the fear of failing in a new career, this had a lot to do with the unknowns in front of me. I found that the best reassurance was to take stock of what I had accomplished so far, and we've heard a bit about that, and to remind myself that if I could nearly reach a PhD level in a field as challenging as classics, I could surely learn whatever industry might throw at me. And I'm pretty sure the same is true of everyone in this room. In this way, past years of study should become a source of strength and confidence rather than a sunk cost to which to cling. Then there's disappointment on this happy talk. Finally, in this decision process, there's disappointing others. This may have been the hardest for me, at least. A wonderful property of graduate school is building up deep relationships with faculty members such that they can provide close, carefully considered advice on a range of complex topics, and yet these were precisely the people I felt incapable of approaching to discuss this most important of decisions. I felt a strong debt and immense gratitude to those who had invested their time, energy, and most of all their faith in me, and I had a hard time escaping the feeling that I was letting them down. I can say more about that later, but ultimately, just remember it's your decision about your life, not theirs. So, freed to make the decision that was right for me, I signed the offer letter and embarked in my new direction. Here, quickly, are some of the aspects of the transition that were difficult or surprising. The first part of the transition involves telling people, and it's at this point that your story will be created, so plan accordingly. I didn't want to leave things on bad terms, and I also did not want to create the failure narrative of Max couldn't succeed in classics, so he left the field. Practically speaking, this means focusing on the positives of the new direction rather than expressing discouragement about the field. While I did usually mention the academic job market with my academic advisors in my reasons for the decision, I stayed away from other evaluative generalizations about the academy. And in fact, with potential employers outside the academy, I didn't mention the academic job market at all, but instead emphasized on what I wanted to do next with my career, how interested I was in the technology, what skills I had already learned on my own, and most of all, a hungry willingness to learn anything else. Something that seemed difficult at the time, but actually turned out to be quite easy in retrospect, was building skills in the new field. To be completely honest, I felt like a complete imposter in my first year due to my utter lack of formal training in anything business or technology related, but I just decided to go with it and embrace it. I put on my novice hat. And just as I had done initially in my first few summers, I simply asked friendly, experienced colleagues that I could trust how they were learning and what they were reading or doing to learn it, and most importantly, I then followed through and learned it myself. Not only does this usually produce the best results the fastest, but it also disarms them and shows more experienced colleagues respect by letting them teach you. It's not the easiest thing to do after reaching a PhD status to become a novice again, but once you can make that mental shift, you'll find that learning the skills for you is surprisingly easy. Marketing yourself. As my career progressed, the non-technical aspects of my profession became increasingly important. This led to another surprise. When I was making the decision, I had been concerned about the need in business for networking and self-promotion and all of these nasty things. I had what might be described as a poetic image of myself as a scholar working mostly in hermit-like isolation by the soft glow of a laptop alone in Firestone Library. And then when I thought about it a little bit harder, I realized that I'd already been thinking consciously as a graduate student about how to construct a professional image, choosing which conferences to attend, how to present myself in print and online, rehearsing presentations, talks, learning how to respect and challenge each other's views in a constructive way. These were all precisely the same activities that were needed in business, but with a somewhat different vocabulary and set of marketing strategies go along with them. In fact, my training had probably prepared me better for these things than someone who had went straight from an engineering degree right into the workplace. Writing. A small thing that surprised me in its difficulty was business writing, of all things. It took me some time to become accustomed to what I thought of as a dreadfully flat, completely functional prose style. I considered myself a decent writer, yet my first few work documents and emails were a complete disaster. They may have been beautifully constructed, glittering snowflakes of verbal aptitude, but they took me far too long to write, and they didn't just bluntly state what I was asking someone to do or what my conclusion was. So that was a surprise. As for the professional foundation that graduate training in classics in particular provides, several themes are worth mentioning. First is an ability, as we've heard, to find meaning in a large, heterogeneous, fragmentary corpus of evidence. As if this were not challenging enough on its own, classics, more than most other fields, often requires significant technical learnings in domains as varied as numismatics, epigraphy, papyrology, etc. Outside the academy, the point is not your deep understanding and knowledge of Lydian coinage, but the fact that you were able to master a difficult body of material fearlessly and able to make sense of it through an analytical framework. You are trained to do this again with other types of material and to replicate this high bar of skill and analytical ability in other settings. A related theme is the ability to construct a coherent argument from this often abstruse material and present it persuasively to both specialists and non-specialists. I'm grateful for this ability every time I see a highly competent software engineer struggle to communicate clearly the reason for a design decision to non-technical colleagues, or conversely, when I see presentations that reveal the speaker's inability to learn the underlying material. Finally, the close reading and linguistic training that is required in learning ancient Greek and Latin turned out to be personally helpful in learning both Java and C++. Not to press the analogy too far, but ancient languages and software languages both seem terrifying at first to the uninitiated, yet have more or less documented rules of syntax, grammar, and ways of expressing logic, in addition to local variances in idiom and dialect. Outside the realm of software, when I'm working on a negotiation or a contract with an outside party, close parsing of language is most certainly a critical skill. So the epilogue. More than a decade after leaving the academy, when I look back at whether I made the right decision, the answer for me is a clear, unconflicted yes. I find challenge and creativity in my career, and while both Google and Morgan Stanley have been intense places to work, I also find a sense of personal balance that I began to feel that I had lost. There is a healthy separation of work time and personal time. I learned, this was news to me, that a weekend is not just another work day without meetings and students, and that a vacation is not just a different, warmer place to take my laptop. When I needed to relocate a few years ago to the opposite end of the country because of my wife's academic career, I was also struck by my location flexibility. My interest in classics is not diminished. I've kept many of my classics books because they're like my old friends, and I enjoy following the field. The difference is that it's strictly on my terms and for my own interest, edification, or reading pleasure without any embedded professional concerns or obligations. So my talk today represents one classicist's journey away from the academy, and what made that journey a happy one were two keys, as I hope to have made clear. The first, being able to disentangle the decision process from sunk cost, fear, and disappointment in order to make an authentic decision about the future. Express another way, I wanted to be sure I was going to run to something and seize the opportunity by precipitating the change myself, not run from something or wait until the situation somehow became more clear or desperate. The second was being able to work through the transition by embracing my novice status and still relying on my training in classics to provide the right foundation for learning, analysis, and argument. Thank you. And any quick questions, or I guess we're going to
make a transition to law.
Transition, so excellent.
Quick questions first, I guess.
Yes.
So do you live and work in Palo Alto?
I actually live in Berkeley and work in San Francisco. There's a Google San Francisco office that I commute to, so. Anything else? Yes. Well, at Google, there's google.com/jobs. But I think one of the things that probably hopefully came through was that in my case, this was not a matter of sending a cold resume into some giant faceless job system. This was working in things, situations that were less than ideal for some time, building relationships, and then finding that those relationships turned into opportunities. And there's an old saying that, you know, the networks and so forth that you build are what create these jobs often than cold calling.